This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Secrets She Carried by Barbara Davis, narrated by Tiffany Morgan. Prologue. Adele. Peak Plantation, 1940. I believe it's the cold I remember most. Yes, I still feel the cold. I still feel a lot of things, like the deep-down shiver of my sweet little Maggie as she stands beside her daddy, stealing fingers the color of bone into his calloused brown hand, needing his warmth. But there is no warmth in him, my poor dear Henry, and it grinds my heart to see it. Yes, I still have a heart, too, or an ache, at least, where it used to be. Maggie clutches at the buttoned-up collar of her black wool coat, hunching her shoulders as if to hoard her heat. I want to scold her for not remembering her gloves, and Henry, too, for not looking after her. He's dressed her up, I see, put her in her yellow dress from last Easter, the one with the bow in back. Already her knees are blue with cold. But it's not in me to be angry. The man next to Maggie hardly resembles the one I knew, and I knew Henry Gavin well. He's hollowed out now, hardly there at all, though his boots still leave prints in the earth, and he never leaves off staring at that stone. I knew right off where he was going when he cranked up that old truck, and I knew right off why. He means to tell her. She's a beautiful child. Her face is so still and pale, like a doll's, the fine blue-white of China, and her gray eyes are wide and shimmery from the chill. My arms long to go around her, to hold her close, to keep her warm and guard her against all that may come. For a moment, the pain is so raw it nearly bends me in two. You forget sometimes to steel yourself against those moments. You think it all stops, but it doesn't. You can still hurt long after you're dead and gone. Well, if the child must know, and it seems she must, I wish it were me doing the telling. Men don't do these things well. She's already confused. I could see it in her face when he got out of the truck and started walking, and I see it again now as she follows her daddy's eyes to the pale slab of soapstone. It's my stone, my bones that lie beneath that mound of dark earth, all fenced in with pretty black iron. There's a gate with two doves and a shiny brass lock to keep me in my place. Too late for that, I guess. There are words inscribed there, but no dates and no name. Thank heaven at least for that. The sun comes through the clouds like ice water, and the wind makes a sound like crying. Maggie's hair lifts out around her head like smoke. "It's beautiful, Daddy," is all she can think to whisper. Her voice is soft as a secret. Henry isn't wearing a coat over his gray flannel suit, and the breeze yanks at his tie, whipping it like a flag over one shoulder. His eyes look so tired, so far away. He doesn't blink, just stares back at her with his Adam's apple bobbing against his collar. His mouth begins to churn finally, but no words come, and all at once there are no more questions in his daughter's eyes. What can the old fool be thinking? He must see that no good can come of it. Even the child knows that. And what in God's name would the fine folk of Gavin, North Carolina, have to say if they learned he had buried his wife's maid up on his precious ridge? I don't belong here. There are places for us, separate places far off from our betters. My stone should be proof enough of that. We've already given those stiff necks and their kind enough wood to burn. Maggie tries again for her father's hand, but he's forgotten she's there. She steps to the stone alone and goes to her knees. Her fingers are blue as she folds them beneath her chin. It's the first time I've wanted to cry, and the first time I realize I no longer can. It doesn't seem fair when your heart still aches so, but so much isn't fair.
It's time to go, child,
Henry calls out. His voice is thick and unfamiliar, like when you wake from a dream.
I've got work to do, and you're...
He stops, glances away, clears his throat.
Your mama will be wondering where you got to.
Maggie stands facing him. Her knees are stained, and she scrubs at them with the heels of her hands. I'm relieved that they're going. He sees now that it's the wrong time to tell her, that it will always be the wrong time. There's no point, after all. Not anymore. But Maggie isn't ready to go. She turns back, bending to read the stone's brief inscription. Her mouth moves over the words. Words so precious, I feel them like a wound. I shall but love thee better after death. The eyes she turns to her father are shiny with tears, her tiny shoulders rack with silent sobs, and in that moment I see Henry change his mind.
Maggie, I want you to listen.
His voice is dry like paper as he clamps his rough brown hands on her shoulders.
There's something I...
But she won't listen. She claps her fists over her ears, shakes her head from side to side, and her words wrench my soul. Never say it, she whispers. If you say it, then it's true. For a moment, Henry goes rigid, and I believe he will fall into little pieces at the child's feet. The air goes out of him suddenly, a long, slow gush of breath, a kind of caving in. It makes him smaller somehow, frail in a way I never noticed. Let it go, Henry. You must leave it where it stands. The child has asked you to. Maggie has him by the sleeve now, tugging him against his will back to the present. We better get back, she says, her voice strangely grown up. Mama's going to want to know where we've been. We'll stop up at Jackson's and get you some cigarettes. You can tell her you ran into old man Ganey or somebody. She starts for the truck then, her cold blue fists knotted at her sides. I can tell by the tilt of her head that she's listening for footsteps, but there are no footsteps, only the low keening of her daddy's heart breaking wide open. Chapter 1. Leslie, New York City, 2013. Leslie Nichols eyed the answering machine's cool blue pulse with fresh dread. If she'd learned anything in her 37 years, it was that flashing blue lights usually meant trouble, and whatever was waiting for her on that machine would prove no exception. She knew it the same way she knew today's stack of mail meant trouble. No surprise, really. It had been that kind of a year. A demoralizing charade of let's-keep-in-touch lunches that never went anywhere. It was almost hard to believe. 2 years ago, she'd been the hottest name in the industry, the up-and-coming diva of the luxury lifestyle spread. Now, thanks to electronic media's blight on the magazine world, she couldn't even find a job. Print publications were quickly becoming endangered species, with new launches like Edge, the magazine she'd almost single-handedly put on the map, among the first to become extinct, leaving her with a stack of unpaid bills and a plummeting bank balance. As she kicked off her shoes, she gave the mail a quick shuffle. No surprises, since the senders had been thoughtful enough to stamp past due and final notice all over the envelopes. Then, held her breath and jabbed the answering machine's message button. Leslie let her breath go when she heard the familiar voice, Gwen Waters from the offices of Goddard and Goddard. At least she didn't owe them money. In fact, she wasn't even sure why they were still pestering her. Maggie's estate had nothing to do with her. There was nothing for her at Peak Plantation, just questions and ghosts, neither of which she cared to confront after 30 years of carefully preserved distance. Nothing that belonged to her, and certainly nothing she deserved. After a year of unreturned phone calls, she would have thought she'd made that much clear. But Gwen Waters was still talking, something about the window for Leslie to claim her grandmother's estate set to expire at the end of the month, about the property defaulting to another beneficiary if she didn't contact their office in the next 48 hours. Leslie blinked at the machine as the message ran out. Another beneficiary? Before she could hit the button to replay the message, a new voice filled the small kitchen, deep and familiar and far less pleasant. The floor seemed to shift as it penetrated, like bourbon and smoke cutting across the distance and the latest gap of years. No explanation, no apology, just Jimmy. She didn't listen to the whole thing. She didn't have to. It was the same message he left every few years. He was about to become a free man and would need a bit of cash to finance his reentry into society. Yes, sir, he sure was looking forward to seeing his baby girl. So, here it was then, the trouble she knew she'd find at the other end of that pulsing blue light. Jimmy. That she didn't want to see him made no difference. He would show up on her doorstep unless, of course, she made it worth his while to stay away, which was the part he never said but always meant. It was how things worked between them. The last time she tried telling him no, she came home to find him on the sidewalk in front of her building with a prison haircut and an old green suitcase. She had written him a check on the spot. Only this time there wasn't any money. The thought of Jimmy moving in brought a clammy wave of panic, the kind she'd experienced often while growing up, but believed she had outgrown, or at least outdistanced. Now that distance appeared to be shrinking. Under the circumstances, it hardly seemed fair. But then, in her experience, fate was rarely fair. Time, once again, to gird her loins. Maybe her life was a huge question mark at the moment, but she'd be damned if she'd let a boozy ex-con add to the tangle, even if that ex-con was her father. Staring at the stack of unpaid bills still clutched in her fist, Leslie choked back a bubble of laughter. Fate might not be fair, but it definitely had a sense of humor. Maybe there was a reason Gwen Waters called today with her time limit and threat of another beneficiary. Maybe it was to remind her that while she didn't have many options, she did have at least one. Going back to Peak was an absurd idea, and yet the more she pondered it, the more it made perfect sense. In Gavin, she'd be miserable but safe. And if Jimmy did figure out where she was, she doubted he'd have the nerve to show his face. Still, the thought of going back made her palms go sticky. It would mean giving up her apartment, as good as an admission of defeat, but it would buy her some time. She could disappear for a while, raise some cash with the sale of the plantation, not much probably, but enough to keep her afloat until she found a job. Leaving the bills on the counter, she wandered into the living room and poured herself a drink, then headed for her favorite chair, a sleek red leather cube that had cost her 2 weeks' pay. She had grown to love New York, especially at this time of day, when the sun began to slide and the light melted like butter onto the buildings, washing the skyline like an old sepia shot. Was she really ready to walk away? To give up her swanky address and the prospect, however dim, of another six-figure salary? The thought left her hollow, but then so did the thought of Jimmy camped out on her doorstep. Too restless to sit, she pushed out of her chair and stepped to the window. Her knees felt like slinkies as she stared at the cars crawling like so many ants on the street below. The vodka was doing its work. A few more and she wouldn't give a damn. Except she had to give a damn. She had to make a decision. Jimmy's message said a couple of weeks. That wasn't much time. 30 years was a lot of time, though. 30 years since the inquest into her mother's death. 30 years trying to outrun demons she wasn't even sure were real. Maybe Jimmy wasn't the only reason to return to Peak, or even the best one. New York didn't offer much at the moment. No work, no love life, a handful of acquaintances she barely saw anymore. Maybe it was time to stop running and finally confront those demons, real or imagined, while Peak still belonged to her. Maybe it was simply time to go home. Leslie felt stiff and cranky, the highway a blur of asphalt and gritty guardrail as she crossed over into North Carolina. It had taken just 3 days to tie up the loose ends of her life, a fact she found too depressing to examine in any depth. The truth was, aside from her apartment, which she'd managed to sublet to an old work colleague, and a designer wardrobe she had consigned to storage with the certainty that she'd never wear any of it again, there had been precious little to handle. She still wasn't convinced that going back wasn't a huge mistake. She just hadn't been able to find enough reasons to stay. Jimmy would go to New York, but this time, when he knocked on her door, she wouldn't be there. There wasn't much about her father that made her laugh, but it was hard not to smirk at the thought of him being greeted by Doug Summers, with his eyebrow ring and platinum hair, or better yet, by his partner Stephen, whose weekend taste tended toward knockoff Vera Wang. A sign for SR-86 suddenly loomed. Leslie jerked the wheel, waving an apology to the blaring horn behind her as she jumped 3 lanes of traffic. The sign at the foot of the ramp said 50 miles to Gavin. She wished it was more. Her stomach clenched unpleasantly when she finally turned onto Gavin Boulevard, the 2-lane road that cut through the heart of town. Almost nothing had changed. Here and there, pale steeples thrust themselves against the hot blue sky. Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, in place since time immemorial. The Gavin Town Hall still stood proudly, every brick and blade as it ever was, on what had once been an honest-to-God drilling green. The Mule and Tobacco Exchange still occupied the block between Meeting and Market, though a good half-century had passed since it had traded either. It took less than 5 minutes to cover downtown. On the way out, she passed the Anytime Diner, a tarnished silver box in a half-paved parking lot, its neon sign flickering, Last Chance for Eats. It had been her favorite place once, a reward for good report cards and A's on spelling tests. Then Jimmy had started sneaking around with Rachel Ranson, whose daddy owned the place, and no one would take her there anymore. Goosing the pedal, she pushed through a wide curve, then flattened out on the narrow road that skirted Gavin, 2 lanes of pocked gray pavement that sent the late-day heat up in shiny waves. The air was full of hay and horse and fertilizer. She was getting close. When Peak finally came into view, it was unexpected somehow, like a full white moon at 4 in the afternoon. Leslie let the car slow to a crawl. She had expected it to be smaller, like all childhood places when you visited them as an adult. She had also expected it to be half falling down. It was neither. It was just as she remembered, lofty and bone white on its jade green hill, boasting a full complement of freshly painted porches and columns. She parked on a patch of gravel meant for guests and sat with the car running, knuckles white against the wheel. She wasn't ready to be here. Maybe it wasn't too late to turn around and go back to New York. Maybe Doug and Stephen would let her have the spare room. After a few minutes, she killed the engine and got out. The air was as thick as syrup, sticky and still and humming with tiny insects. A film of sweat beaded her upper lip as she paused in the driveway to take in old landmarks. The small cottage back in the trees, the lake where she'd learned to swim, and in the distance, the jutting shelf of land named for the great-grandfather she had never known, Henry's Ridge. Pivoting slowly, Leslie let her eyes roam the fields, scanning row upon row of trellised vines where acres of bright leaf once stood. She hadn't expected tobacco. Her grandmother had put a stop to that the day they buried her husband, a martyr to his two-pack-a-day habit. But she certainly hadn't expected grapes, either. Whose idea? Never mind. It would keep until tomorrow when she met with the attorneys. Right now, all she wanted was to get through this part. Seeing the foyer and the stairs would be the worst. After that, she'd be fine. She was halfway up the walk when she realized she hadn't given a thought to how she might get in the house. It simply hadn't occurred to her. Maggie had never locked the doors. No one in Gavin did. She eyed the knocker a moment, a big brass oval with a cursive P carved into its heart, then realized with a small shock that the door was actually ajar. Giving it a nudge, she stepped inside. Her eyes were slow to adjust, but gradually shadows grew solid. A ladder-backed chair, a heavy oak hall tree, a banjo clock. Her gaze slid to the foot of the stairs, to the small Turkish rug at the base of the last step. What would she find if she lifted it? Would the stain still be visible after so many years? Leslie's throat thickened as the memory surfaced, the dark, vicious pool of her mother's blood spreading over the freshly polished floorboards, the scissors glittering sharply between her ribs. Pressing back against the wall, she sidled toward the parlor. She wasn't ready to think about that day. Not yet.
Hello?
Leslie's head snapped up as if it were on marionette strings. The disembodied voice came again, louder this time, echoing down the staircase. Is someone there? There were footsteps on the landing now. He, whoever he was, stood midway down the stairs, a stepladder dangling from one shoulder. He wore jeans with one knee blown out, work boots worn dark at the toes, and a shirt that was more out than in. A repairman, Leslie guessed, probably sent by the attorneys after she called to tell them she was on her way.
Well, 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 he said, propping the ladder against the banister. The prodigal granddaughter has returned at last.
Leslie blinked up at him, startled by the undisguised hostility in his voice. Before she could think of a response, he was down the stairs and standing in front of her. His eyes raked her coolly, missing nothing along the way. Jay Davenport, he said at last, extending a hand. Leslie shook it briefly, registering calloused fingers, nails white with caulk. She could see his face now angled and tan, with a fresh overlay of sunburn. Pale creases fanned out from the corners of eyes the smoky amber of single malt scotch.
You work here, I assume?
Something like that, he answered without a hint of a smile. Goddard said you'd finally decided to show up.
There it was again, that snarky, undisguised antagonism. Leslie let her breath out slowly. She was too tired for a battle with a handyman, or anyone for that matter. What is it you do around here, Mr. Davenport? Maggie's been gone almost a year. The amber eyes narrowed.
You call her Maggie?
It was her name, and you've changed the subject. A tiny pulse appeared along the right side of his jaw.
Your grandmother and I had an arrangement, Miss Nichols, which you'd know if you'd ever bothered to pick up a phone. I must say, your devotion is touching. It only took you a year to get here.
Leslie's mouth worked mutely as she shuffled through her deck of excuses, discarding them one by one. She deserved every word, of course, though certainly not from this stranger, whoever he might be. She would have told him so, too, if he hadn't already stalked past her and out the door.
Standing alone in the foyer, Leslie felt the silence crowding in, thick with time and memory. From somewhere in the house came the distant tick of a clock, as steady and sure as a heartbeat, unnerving somehow against the quiet. Could she do this? Live in this house with its uneasy memories? She had convinced herself it was what she needed to do, face it all head on, stare down her guilt, sort out her questions. Now she wasn't sure. Stepping into the parlor, she let her eyes roam the familiar, resting a moment to digest some small memory before moving on. The furniture was far from grand. A striped sofa of green and gold brocade that had once been plush but now leaned toward shabby, a pair of brocade wingbacks a bit saggy in the seat, a walnut table scattered with family photos. The closest one was framed in heavy silver. She picked it up. She had no memory of Henry Gavin, Maggie's father, and the man who'd made Peak the legend it had once been. He looked to have been in his 30s when the photograph was taken, rough-hewn and handsome in a Gary Cooper sort of way, his dark suit hanging on his lean frame like someone else's skin. Returning Henry's photo to its place, she moved on to the next, a colt-legged version of herself at 5 or 6, preening in a swimsuit with a frilly ballerina skirt. Her mother's picture was there, too, a dark-haired beauty of 16 or so in a sundress and sandals. Seeing it beside her own took Leslie off guard. It was startling to realize just how much she resembled Amanda Nichols. How many times had she tried in vain to conjure her mother's face when all she needed to do was look in a mirror? Her eyes slid to the portrait above the mantel, Maggie in bridal lace and the Gavin family pearls. Here, too, her own features were visible. Clearly, the Gavin genes ran strong. Maggie's room at the back of the house was eerily unchanged. The old tester bed Leslie had napped in as a child still bloomed with pink and yellow roses. The vanity where she had played dress-up still winked with its collection of silver-topped jars, and Maggie's jewelry box. Lifting the lid, she picked through the tangle of costume pieces, looking for the pair of black velvet pouches her grandmother had always nestled near the bottom. She hadn't thought of them in years, but was strangely relieved now to find them where they belonged. Breath held, she poured out the contents of the first pouch, a strand of creamy pearls as cool and smooth as satin against her palm, a blood-red garnet winking in the heavy filigree gold clasp. One day these will be yours, one day when I'm gone. She had never bothered to inquire just where it was her grandmother was going, but then children never put much stock in one day, perhaps because one day never seemed to come. Her throat burned a little as she returned the first pouch to the jewelry box and picked up the second. Its contents had always been a mystery, presumably too fragile or precious for dress-up, but she was all grown up now, and there was no one to tell her no. She worked a moment at the strings, then teased out the contents, gasping as the pale blue cameo fell into her hand. It was a beautiful piece, exquisitely carved, set in intricately woven loops of silver, but she had no recollection of Maggie ever wearing it. Lifting the cameo to her throat, she peered at her reflection in the trifold mirror and found herself startled again by her resemblance to Maggie and to her mother. Ghosts. Everywhere she looked. Ghosts. Chapter 2 J. Peak Plantation, 2013. Jay